Thanks, Jen. Hey, everybody. It's Bill Leff. It's Wendy Snyder. I thought some words were going to kick in, but no words kicked in on the song.
No, you ruined my groove.
Do you have a groove going?
I'm a jazzbo now.
Oh, I didn't realize that. I'll give way. I'll give way then. Hi, guys. It's Bill Leff. It's Wendy Snyder. This is the show. Welcome to it. 312-981-7200. Should you want to call in or text in, we would love to hear from you. You have to admit, these teacher demonstrations, these marches, are very impressive.
So with you on this, because what way other than to clog traffic to make people notice what's going on? Yeah. Although, what does that do?
I honestly, I always think about that, and I don't know.
It puts pressure on. It brings it more to the forefront. I get that.
Right.
I feel bad for the teachers. Some texts coming through. Teachers should be fired for striking. Why? Mm. No. And then you think it's a problem now?
Right.
If all these teachers are fired, who's going to teach these kids?
Right.
300,000 kids just hanging out.
300,000 kids.
Yeah. When there's a teacher shortage in the state anyway?
You have to realize you'd be living under a rock to not know that this teacher strike is going on. So if you're saying that it's creating an awareness, yes and no. There's already an awareness, obviously, because it's, you know, it's the biggest story in the city right now. So there also, the awareness already exists. I never understand exactly what good it does, and yet at the same exact time as I say that, I appreciate that
too.
Because one of the benefits of living in a free society is you have the right to say, my working conditions are such and I would like them to be improved, so what can I do to improve them? Sometimes that's money, sometimes that's time. It's, you know, it's a myriad of things, but I applaud the way that this all came together. And yeah, it makes things uncomfortable for the rest of us. If you have to get from point A to point B and there's a march going past you, it's going to screw up your time a little bit. I understand that.
But what can I do to help? Who do I call? Do I call someone?
That's the problem.
I side with them. I got to be honest with you. Striking would be a very scary thing to think about.
Sure.
If all of a sudden we went out on strike, I don't know, maybe I'd be a scab. I don't know. They're not getting paid for their time out of the classroom.
I'm sure you've seen this a bunch of times in your lifetime where you pass by a building and maybe it's a hotel where the people who work in the hotel are striking, or maybe it's a building that's being built and it's, you know, it's the construction workers that are striking. And
are you going to bring up Scabby the rat?
Well, there's always a giant inflatable rat. Do those things ever go on strike? Do the people who make inflatable rats ever go on strike? Because who shows up to that?
That is a great question.
So I always wonder to myself as I'm watching this, I don't know all the facts. I'm sure, I'm positive that both sides have something right. I'm positive because that's almost any great debate. They're kind of right and they're kind of right. The problem is, how do you fuse those two together to get some sort of compromise? But I never know exactly what I could do, should do, will do. It creates the awareness that we said earlier. You go, okay, they're not happy with their work conditions. What's my next move? I don't know what I do now. And that's what's going on with the teacher strike. I don't want them striking. I want the kids to be in school. I want the teachers to be making a living teaching kids, doing what they're here for. But I don't know what I'm supposed to do now.
I don't either. And I want the kids to have a better learning experience,
sure,
like smaller class size.
Sure.
Hearing some of these things that there's one teacher for like 48 kids, that is unacceptable.
You know, it's really strange. I don't remember every class I was in grade school, but on average, the classes that I had in grade school were 25 to 30 kids. It didn't seem too big. It didn't seem too small because that's what I was accustomed to, a class that had 25 to 30 kids. So I've been told by more than one person who is currently a teacher, they said, you don't know what it's like now. A class of 30 kids is not like a class of 30 kids back in the 60s and the 70s. And I said, please explain. And they always say, because there's so much other stimuli going on, everything from cell phones, you know, kids in grade schools that have cell phones, so they're texting or they're talking on their phone or they're playing a game, to just the general wear and tear of a school day. She said, this one particular teacher, it's not like, I mean, 30 used to be a very manageable number in a classroom. It's not anymore. And I haven't been in a classroom in years and years and years, so I can't reference that. I don't know.
That seems even high. I don't think we had classes of 30 students when I was in high school.
What were yours at about? Do you remember? Hard to say.
I can't remember, Bill. Maybe 20.
But all right. So 20 to us would have been a luxury. We, like I said, we were in the 25 to 30. But when I think about if there were more than that, like these teachers now are saying 35 and 40, that would be nearly impossible. You're by yourself. You're dealing with 40 kids in a classroom.
I can't imagine it.
It's impossible.
And how do you learn? Yeah. A lot of feelings both ways. Teachers should never walk out on the students. And, you know,
but they need to get their point across. So if you don't do that, if you don't say, hey, I'm going to act on this, these aren't just words, I'm going to act on this, how do you do that?
I don't know how you do it. And I just know if I was Lori Lightfoot, I know she knew what she was walking into when she took this job. Yeah. I would resign if I were her.
Wouldn't that look? That'd be the worst thing.
Well, I'm a quitter.
Horrible.
That's what I am. Because I don't know how this is going to be settled. If you don't have the money.
Right.
How do you get the money?
Right.
I don't understand.
Yeah.
It's not like, you know, Lori Lightfoot's holding out saying, you know, I don't agree with smaller class size and social workers and nurses. But how do you make ends meet?
Don't you think a city, for the most part, is like most of our households in that things need to be done. There needs to be maintenance and care. And, you know, it costs things. Whatever you're doing, it costs something. And it's just almost impossible to bring in enough money to make it a smooth move where you can pay off everything you need to pay off. We're all familiar with this on a household basis. You know, you have some sort of a budget for your household and you can't really exceed it. For some reason, cities somehow get around it. You know, they push money here. I guess we do that in households to some extent too, where you move money around
a little bit to make it happen.
But I can't imagine, you know, you hear the numbers that are involved with a city the size of Chicago and what their budget is, and that's going to get very interesting today as budgets are announced. So, you know, yeah, she knew what was coming in. I wonder how many people said to her, you know, this is coming up faster, much more faster than you think.
And coming up to a head, yeah. You know. 630 has the correct response. Millennials aren't even having kids anymore. Problem solved.
Oh.
Wish it was that easy.
that was easy. Wow, I didn't think it would be solved that simply. All right, let's do this. We'll take a quick break. If you want to discuss this, we'd love to talk to you. We're at 312-981-7200. Let's hear your opinions. It's Bill Leffin. It's Wendy Snyder on WGN.
Up in the morning and out to school. The teacher is teaching the golden rule.
All right, the Chicago Teachers Union, the Chicago Public Schools, they're at odds. They're striking today. They are clogging up some traffic and ultimately ending up where?
City Hall, I think,
yes.
Right?
Yeah. Yes. Who do you want to take, Bill? Let's talk to Mary. Mary has called us. 312-981-7200. Hi, Mary.
Hi. My comment is, the teachers keep saying it's not about the money. B, I have not heard anyone say we're willing to give up a third of our raise or half of our raise to free up money for more teachers or the new positions they want.
Why should they have to do that is my question.
Because I think if they wouldn't keep pressing that it's not about the money, it just seems contradictory to what they're saying. They keep saying it's not about the money, it's not about the money, but they're not willing to give up any type of money.
I do know that a lot of teachers put their own money forth to purchase things for the classroom. And, I mean, Mary, think about it. Would you want to sacrifice money that you have earned to solve a problem that's...
All right, now let me tell you this. I'm in my 80s, my early 80s.
God love you.
I was a teacher for 15 years. You're right. Our school, it wasn't in Chicago. We had no budget for art supplies. Every Friday, I bet you during the year I must have spent $2,000 on construction paper, crayons, Google Eyes, pom-poms to make crafts. But you know what? That's what I chose to do. There was nobody putting a gun to my head and saying I had to be a teacher.
I understand that.
I mean, I did spend my own money, and thank God my husband worked. I was fortunate. I could do it, but I was not wealthy. But at any time, I could have said, well, I'm not making... When do you go to a job, and the job says, this is your salary, and then you come back a year or two later and say, I want more money. I'm not happy with what you're paying me.
Well, people deserve raises, and the other side of that, Mary, is what if you agreed on a term to get paid, and all of a sudden they're going to take money away from you?
Well, that I wouldn't agree to.
It's a tough situation.
Yeah, it is. But I'm just saying, I think what sticks in my craw is they keep making the statement, it's not about the money. And that's what kind of bugs me, because if it's not about the money and the city is short on their funding, then maybe you should relax some of your demands for your salary or for your raise.
We thank you for your opinion,
okay.
Mary.
Okay.
I don't know what the answer
is. When it breaks down, and I know that I've heard the phrase, it's not about the money. I've heard it bandied about. It's not like it's not their major calling card, but it does play into it. But really, basically, isn't almost everything about money?
Well, yeah, because you got to pay your bills. And yeah. I'll be honest with you, if you're becoming a teacher, you're not becoming a teacher to get rich.
Right. Right.
So it's about the money to pay your bills.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Here's another former teacher. Hi, Esther.
Hey, how you doing? Haven't heard from you. I talked to her a long time.
Oh, we've missed you. How's it going?
Okay, you and Bill, I think you two need to be in the hospital, but that's okay.
Thanks, Esther. You may get your wish.
I don't know. Wendy, you about the age of my daughter. And I taught school back in the day. And asking a teacher to have 35 or 40 middle-aged kids in a class is a little much. It's going to take her a month to get to know everybody's name. And that's a lot of work, and it's hard. And I retired a number of years ago. And I don't think they have enough money to put me back in the classroom now. It's hard work.
I know.
Well, Esther, it's also just keeping focus in a room with 35 or 40 people, kids or otherwise, is nearly impossible, isn't it?
It really is. And middle school kids, they are just, their minds are everywhere. And now with phones, et cetera, it's a little much. And whether it's about the money or not. And when I was teaching, there were not a lot of teachers who had to buy things for their classroom. It was there. And I don't know how all that equates in Chicago, because I taught in a smaller community. But it's hard work. And usually I had 20 kids. And then we had another program to help kids who needed more help. They lowered the classroom size. So when I stopped teaching, I had about 15 kids in my class. And it was easier to work with them, to get them to learn, to get them to focus. How are you going to get 40 kids to focus?
You're not going to.
No.
Esther.
Well, it's nice talking with the two of you.
Thanks, Esther.
You've been listening, even though you haven't been calling, because we have missed you.
Oh, well, I definitely listen. And I know Bill came up before they had teachers in the classroom. But I enjoy you have it's informative and it's fun.
Thanks,
Keep
Esther.
Doing good work.
If we do end up in the hospital, we hope you'll come and visit us.
All right. Just let me know which one. All right. I don't want to get locked up in there with you. Okay.
All right. Thank you.
Thank Bye. You, Esther. We've missed you. God, I love her. And we have time for one more. Brian has called us. Hey, Brian, what are your thoughts on all this?
My question is, when you go on strike, you're supposed to strike for your financial or something for you, but these teachers are striking for what the parents should be complaining about. Librarians, nurses, you know, stuff like that. That's something the parents should be complaining about, going to the district about, complaining about. Why are the teachers stepping in and stopping the kids from going to school when that's not their fight?
Brian, I've thought about that too. Why do you think more parents aren't on that battle? That's really strange that it's mostly the teachers complaining or bringing these things to light instead of the parents. Why do you think that is?
Well, in my personal experience, I've seen a lot of parents don't go to the meetings. A lot of parents don't. They complain in the background, but they don't step forward to actually be heard. So I don't know why they don't, but they don't. And I do understand and I do sympathize with the teachers. You know, it is affecting their jobs, but this is something that parents need to be stepping up and complaining about.
Although, what do the parents have to do when they can only send their kid to a specific school depending on where they live, and they send their kid to school and they hope the school takes care of them? I mean, what if a parent complains? Is that going to make any difference?
Well, correct me if I'm wrong, but aren't these officials elected officials? So if your school's not doing something appropriately, shouldn't you take the necessary steps to get them out of there or to put someone in who's going to? I mean, that's their job, not the teacher's.
Yeah.
Teacher's job is to teach.
Well, thankfully, the teachers are sticking up for the kids.
Well, absolutely. Thankfully, someone is.
Yeah. Brian, thank you for your call. We appreciate it.
Wendy, we've got texters wondering why the money that was earmarked for education with things, and it ranges from gambling to the tollway system to the lottery, why isn't that money more sufficient? I would also throw in, marijuana is going to be legalized as of January. Why isn't there some built-in provision where some of the money from that goes into education? And maybe it is, but it's obviously not enough.
I thought all those lottery things, everything went to the schools. And the way people play lottery, even when they don't have money, you
right.
see people waiting in line
right.
and spending the money that I know they don't have to buy all these little Lotto and Powerball things.
Yeah.
They got to be making some money.
Right. I think that every time I'm near a toll plaza and I see how many cars go by in a short span of time as I'm at the toll plaza, and you go, each one of those cars, you know, paying roughly a dollar every time you're passing a toll booth plaza, that's a ton of money.
Yeah.
They can't budget that a little bit better?
This is exactly why I am not in control of anything, because I
why?
Wouldn't know how to do it.
Yeah.
And I mean, I don't know. Maybe parents have complained. I can't speak
well,
on
I'm
that.
I'm positive that they have.
There's lots of parents out there marching with them. I've seen lots of Twitter and Facebook videos from various parents that they're out and they'll bring their kids with and stuff. So there's been a lot of support, but all these parents have full-time jobs. So, you know, they're focused on what they need to do right now.
Someone says, 773, I'm a parent worker at Josephine Carson Locke School in Chicago. Folks that complain about the teachers being on strike and why, maybe these people should sit in their children's schools and observe for a week and maybe they'd understand. It has to be a bad learning environment. As Esther mentioned, 40 kids in the school. You know, sometimes you need to ask the teacher a question.
Right.
And with 40 kids, I wouldn't pay attention. It's difficult.
If you take any 40 people just at random, what percentage are going to be a little bit disruptive, you know?
All right.
We'll start close to home. But it's impossible to have a class of that many people and not have some people, you know, who are just messing it up for everybody else. That's just a numbers game.
That is. And with one person to control all those people, to control and teach, pretty difficult.
Yeah.
And as I was telling you off the air with these school shootings and everything, I was so shocked to find out there was not a nurse at every school.
Right.
There are some kids that require medication that have to visit the nurse throughout the school day. And with all these school shootings, there's a lot of stress and anxiety, a lot of things we didn't have to deal with when we were going to school. And they do need a social worker there.
Yeah, I know. On the other side of the coin, just to be fair, several people have brought up the fact that they have very tough jobs, they don't make that much money, and they don't have any kind of a pension like the teachers are shooting for. And I hear that. I understand that. Every job has its benefits and its detractions. You just have to find a job that you can hopefully balance those out, you know?
And maybe some of these teachers are going to quit if things don't, you know, follow suit and go the right way.
Sure.
We need the teachers. Mike Rowe is waiting in the PPG Paints green room, and he will be on with us after the news to talk about his new book and more. Thank you, Jen. It's Bill Leff. It's Wendy Snyder. And Mike Rowe is joining us. God, I don't know where to begin. Dirty jobs. Somebody's got to do it. You have a podcast, The Way I Heard It, and you also have a book now, which is what? You've taken some highlights of your podcasts and memoirs and put it all together into a book? What? That's, maybe you should explain it.
That's basically it. By the way, was Paul Harvey out of this?
Yes.
And this station, not this studio, but yes, this station.
So Paul Harvey, along with Charles Kuralt, Studs Terkel, Garrison Keillor to some extent, George Plimpton, all those guys.
The storytellers.
The immersed storytellers.
Yeah.
You know, I certainly can't fill their shoes, but with Dirty Jobs, I tried to follow in their footsteps to some degree. But the podcast began as a straight-up homage to Paul Harvey. The way he could make history and biography interesting to people who otherwise wouldn't give a damn always fascinated me by turning their lives into mysteries, you know?
Yeah.
So I started to write in that style, mostly to pass the time on planes. I'm
really?
Up in the air a lot. Yeah. And writing for me, anyway, is one of the few activities that actually compresses time. And I can't tell you how many times I'd start a story on the tarmac at SFO and then look up a few seconds later to see you know, I'm on the tarmac at JFK.
Yeah.
And so I wrote these stories, and then I put them on a podcast, and then one day my producer called and said, hey, genius, these things have been downloaded 120 million times. It might be a thing. So then a publisher called and said, okay, we'll slap some covers on 50 of your favorites and call it a book. And I told my mother, and she said, Michael, that sounds terrific, but gosh, what a lazy way to write a book.
Yeah.
And moms will always be moms.
That's brutally candid.
Yeah.
You know, and so I began to write an accidental memoir that's juxtaposed between these mysteries around famous people who I've never actually met. And what came out was an odd mix of biography, autobiography, mystery, yeah, memoir. And the publisher says it's the feel-good hit of the fall.
Oh, that's nice. Excellent.
There's a commonality. All those names you mentioned of those storytellers.
Sure.
There's a commonality there, Mike. You see the commonality, right?
I think so. I think they...
There's a pacing.
Well, there was a point of view.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, George Plimpton wouldn't write about anything until he had at least
experienced it.
Yeah. So whether it's bullfighting or boxing or football,
yeah,
he wanted to be able to at least say, I tried. Paul Harvey, you know, he had such a strong point of view in at a time when broadcasting really did rely upon a certain cadence,
right,
a certain voice, you know. I mean, and he just owned that.
Yeah.
And yeah, Charles Kuralt, On the Road, you know, all those guys.
Yeah.
And you just don't hear a lot of that kind of storytelling anymore. And again, I don't mean to include myself among them. It's just that I miss them.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, to channel some of that seemed to be a fair and fun thing to attempt.
Yeah.
Do you ever sing any opera on your podcast?
To be clear, this podcast is not like a morning radio show.
Right.
I mean, like, I write a thing and I read it. These are for the curious minds with a short attention span. So I rarely burst
into
song, which is everyone nowadays.
But you're a trained opera singer.
Well, I got into the opera under conditions best described as suspicious and serendipitous.
In Baltimore?
It was in Baltimore, yeah, and I was on a quest to get my union card,
yeah,
for the Screen Actors Guild, because in those days, 1982, 1983, you couldn't audition for like national network spots unless you were in the union, but you couldn't get in the union unless you had done national network spots,
mm-hmm,
right? And so it was a catch-22, but I learned if I got my AGMA card, my American Guild of Musical Artists, I could immediately write a check to the Screen Actors Guild.
Oh.
So the shortest way in was to learn the shortest aria I could find and try and convince the chorus director and the Baltimore Opera to,
yeah,
give me a shot.
Yeah.
And so I did. I auditioned one afternoon, a little aria from Puccini. And he looked at me when this guy speaks five languages, right? Can play anything from memory. And I sing this thing, and he says, Mr. Rowe, your tone is not entirely displeasing, but let's be honest. You have no idea what the hell you're singing about, do you? And I said, no, actually, I don't. But he let me in anyway,
oh,
and it turned out to be more fun than I ever imagined, and so I stuck around for 8 years.
Good. Yeah. Wow.
Crazy.
And last night you were over at Monday night, North Central College, a great campus in Naperville,
yeah,
and you and Rick Kogan had a little talk about the new book, The Way I Heard It. And how could people tell you apart with your voices?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. The guy, I mean, I think we had like a talk-off, you know? I mean, he's interviewing me, and he's like, so Mike, tell me about the things that motivated the book. And I say, well, Rick, I guess maybe we can start there. And suddenly I realize we're all just,
right,
just go graveling it up.
Did Sam Elliott charge the stage at any point during the show?
It's so funny. You know, I did maybe 300 commercials for Ford,
yeah,
and one day I was in the booth, and Sam had just left, and I always loved, back in the day, he used to be the Dodge guy.
Yeah, right.
And he would go, Guts, Glory, Ram. And I was like, man, that's got to be the best VO ever. Three words.
And you're out.
And he's out. I mean, he literally, it took him that long to record the entire campaign.
Ford must have been thrilled with the impact you had on their vehicle, right? They had to be so happy.
Not to brag, but the best thing that happened in that relationship was that the ad agency agreed to revisit their approach to mirror a Dirty Jobs dynamic.
Yeah.
like the first spot I did for them was a Super Bowl spot, and it took 2 days to shoot, and it was very expensive, and it was okay. But 2 years later, we were doing 22 commercials a day, totally unscripted, real people, right? So we were just, I was like, look, just give people a car, and let me check back with them in 3 weeks to see how they liked it, and let's film it. Let them think they're making a documentary, and, and you'll get real, honest reactions. Yeah. And yeah, it changed. It changed the way they talked to their customer base, and it worked for about 8 years. We did a lot of work with them, and they were great supporters of my foundation. They were good partners. It was a privilege to work with
them. I thought it was one of the best examples I've ever seen in advertising, where they found the exact right guy for their target audience. You were the perfect guy for their audience.
At the right time.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, there are no ideas, and everything comes in and out of style. But back in 2007, 2008, yeah. You know, nonfiction TV was changing, which means that nonfiction in general is changing, which means reality is changing, which means suddenly production kind of becomes a barrier to authenticity. And if you were out there in the world doing a nonfiction show, or really being yourself, didn't matter if it was in advertising or programming, man, the viewers suddenly could really smell a fake like never before.
Right.
And it just didn't make any sense to pretend, which is why we never did a second take on Dirty Jobs.
Really?
Never.
Got to be genuine. Yep. And we have to take a break. We are talking with Mike Rowe. You mentioned your foundation. Excuse me. We'll talk about that and the way I heard it. 312-981-7200. It's WGN Radio.
It's Bill and Wendy. Mike Rowe is here, best known as the host of Dirty Jobs. Somebody's Got to Do It, returning the favor. He has a podcast and a book with the same title, The Way I Heard It. When you came in, Mike, I said, and I'm sure I'm not the first person to say this, I'm disappointed you're not wearing your trademark hat. The cap that I've known you to wear for years and years and years is not on you. You said this is a new chapter in my life. Please explain.
I just made that up. Oh. I mean, of course, I you can never say completely goodbye to the cap.
Yeah.
But it all happened by accident. You know, I started wearing caps because I can't stand the whole hair makeup thing.
Yeah.
Right? And so it just
made it easier.
Right. But then when Dirty Jobs hit, I started wearing whatever cap had the logo of whomever I was visiting. You know, it was a nice way to say thanks to them for inviting us you know, wherever we were. And then it just got out of hand.
Oh.
And so, yeah, I was the guy in the cap. It's in real life, no. Everybody's surprised. They're like, oh, you're not bald.
Yeah.
I was almost certain you must have. You had to be bald, but no, I'm just a guy in a cap.
That's all. All right. Yeah. That makes sense.
Well, it's not like you did this special for Mike. You wear one every day.
Right. I wore a nicer one because I knew you were coming in.
Very, very, very tasteful, Liz.
Thank you. Thank you. Very kind.
We spent a lot of time talking before we went on the air. The Mike Rowe Works Foundation. This has been going on for how long? And boy, is it successful.
Thanks. Yeah. In 2008, Dirty Jobs was, I think, the number one show on cable. We were in 200 countries and things had gone well. The economy tanked, as you might recall. And it struck me that it might be nice to do something for the industries that we typically feature on the show. And in the preceding 5 years, every Dirty Jobs ends with me taking the crew out for a beer and usually the people that invited us. And I always talk to them about their business and whatever the challenges are. And the single biggest complaint was always the same. The challenge of recruiting, finding people willing to learn a skill that's in demand and going to work. Even at the height of the recession in 2008, with 10% unemployment, we were still seeing help wanted signs everywhere we went on the show. So it just occurred to me that there was another narrative going on in the country, and it wasn't simply about the number of people who were out of work. There were a couple million jobs that were open and available, and for whatever reason, people just weren't enthused about them. And so MicroWorks started as a kind of grassroots PR campaign for opportunity that actually existed. The fans of the show helped me build a trade resource center online, and we started hooking people up with, call them alternative forms of training, apprenticeships, fellowships, things that didn't cost a lot of money. And from there, it evolved into a scholarship fund. And today, we offer work ethic scholarships. We do a program every year, at least one. And we've given away so far somewhere between $5 and $6 million.
Good golly.
So, yeah, look, there's a There's a really big problem in the country. And, you know, I know there's, you know, a labor thing going on in the city right now. I know teachers, right? And it's so tempting to only look at work through the lens of, you know, labor and management and through this, you know, binary struggle, this ongoing struggle. And I get it. It's real. But there's another struggle. And right now that struggle is defined by 7.3 million available jobs. We have 7.3 million open jobs. The vast majority of them do not require a four-year degree. Mm-hmm. Conversely, we have $1.5 trillion of student loans on the books. We have a 50% dropout rate for people who borrow money to go to school. They don't even finish with their degree, but they do leave with debt. So the debt is a problem, and our tendency as a country to address educational challenges with cookie-cutter solutions is creating all kinds of unintended consequences. And we're just lending money we don't have to kids who can't pay it back to train them for jobs that don't exist anymore. It's crazy.
I just think these colleges and universities, the prices have skyrocketed so high. I know it's great to have a four-year degree. That would be wonderful, but it's not for everyone, and not everyone can afford these exorbitant prices.
Look, it's very, very valuable, this liberal arts degree. Mine served me very well, but it's not priceless. At some point, it's out of whack. I went to a community college for 2.5 years, finished in 82, worked for a year, then I went to a university and wound up with a BS in communications.
Mm-hmm.
Perfectly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, what,
ironically.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
But look, the whole kit and caboodle cost about $11,300.
Yeah.
And I priced it today. Yeah. Same exact courses, same everything, $90,000. So look at it like this. In the history of inflation, nothing worth having has ever gotten more expensive more quickly than a college degree, faster than food, energy, real estate, even healthcare.
Yeah.
Nothing has ever gotten so expensive so fast. And part of the reason is we've freed up an unlimited pile of money and told an entire generation of kids that if they don't get a four-year degree, they are screwed. And they believe it. Parents believe it. Guidance counselors believe it. It's a big, hairy lie.
Yeah.
There are other ways to prosper.
What do you think of this? We have a couple of candidates running on the idea of student loan forgiveness. I say instead of that, work on putting some sort of a ceiling with the schools and universities so that the price can't exceed, shouldn't even come close to exceeding what it's at now. Isn't that more realistic than student loan forgiveness?
Well, I mean, to use the word forgiveness, you know, I mean, it really sounds like, you know,
there was some mistake
of,
involved.
Not a mistake, a sin.
Oh, right.
Right.
Yeah.
We forgive sin.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the other F word, free, is being thrown around an awful lot. And people always ask me what I think of free college. And I'm just like, if you're asking me, do I think professors who agree not to be paid will work in buildings that get constructed by people who agree not to be paid, mm-hmm. and who are maintained by people who agree not to be paid. Like if nobody's getting paid, okay, then I can understand how it might be free.
Mm-hmm.
But everybody's getting paid.
Right.
And the idea of forgiving a debt simply because it's too high, well, it just doesn't add up. What we have to do, I think, is change the way we think about supply and demand when it comes to defining what a good education is.
Yeah.
And we just need to give parents better examples of people who have prospered as a result of learning a skill instead of simply signing on the dotted line, borrowing the necessary funds, and getting their credential. We're drowning in a sea of credentialing, and it's just not working.
Yep.
Most graduates aren't even working in their chosen field.
Isn't that something?
I think, yeah.
The way I heard it, it's a podcast, it's now a book, it's available everywhere, and our last text, can Mike Rowe run for president, pretty please?
All right, why not?
Done okay. Deal. Good. That was fast.
No, wow. It happened here.
Wow. So fast. Mike,
pleasure
great
to
meeting
see you.
Good luck with everything.
Thanks, guys. I appreciate it.
Take a quick break, and then more of us.
And news is next from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom.
Toss a pizza, roll a pizza up and all around the pizza boy. Look at it fly. Toss a pizza, roll a pizza up and all around the pizza boy.
This should be the national anthem.
I kind of agree
with you.
Don't you
think? This would be a better national anthem.
You should change your name to Pete Za. Why don't you do this?
Wendy, just to mess with you, I'm going to change my name to Pizza. Look who's here. It's Dane Neal. Hi, Dane.
Hi, guys.
Nice to see you.
Guys, I noticed the traffic was a little tough getting in because
It's National Pizza Month. You're going to get a little extra traffic.
The parades, the floats, the like I said, the mascots crowding. The
mozzarella all over the highway.
You know, when they said ticker tape and then they meant ticker, you know, mozzarella stick parade.
Right. It gets crazy, doesn't it?
Plus, once they get maybe 10, 11 floors high, they get some velocity.
I know.
Injuries can happen.
What does this mean? It's National Pizza Month. What does this all mean?
Well, isn't every month National Pizza Month?
Should be. That's an excellent point. And that's really a lot of the feedback that we've gotten that here in Chicago, it is always Pizza Month, but as a shining example, a beacon of pizza excellence and example, you know, we kind of project this because the rest of the country that may be into clam chowder, right, or something else, just can't handle like you know a whole year of pizza.
But Dane, the rest of the country recognizes that we are the best at pizza, except New York. New York won't give in to that. They know we are, but they won't give in to it publicly. Yeah. Why does the rest of the country so willingly accept it, but New York keeps fighting it?
Well, New York, just because I think just pompous condescension in general, right? That's, that's really what they're all about.
Right.
There's like a rebel bastion of whatever, but there's been some research, and I think that that has been debunked as well. So they can love their own thing. God bless them, let them do it. But here in Chicago, you know, we do it in so many more places. We do it in so many more styles, more than just the deep dish, which has kind of been the standard bearer for some reasons that we're trying to figure out. And we're celebrating. Celebrating, talking about it. People love it. They love it all the time. Pizza Month is here. Louisa Chu is also here. You know her from her great work, Chicago Tribune, as the Chewing podcast host. And it's great to have her here to help navigate those waters.
Right.
Hi Louisa.
Thanks
Hi.
For being here.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. I really appreciate spending National Pizza Month Day.
Mm.
Yep. With us,
with
yes,
loved ones. Excellent. You got to spend it with loved ones.
For her sash, she just came from the parade float with her crust sash.
Eat it along the way, you know, with that strike traffic.
All right, I've mentioned this before, never with you here, but I'm going to bring this up to you.
Okay.
I've heard people say that because Chicago has the right water for the dough, right? Is there truth to that or is there no truth to that, that water doesn't play an integral role in creating a good pizza crust?
I think magical waters can be very influential to one's mental health. I can't say that scientifically it's been proven.
Yeah.
And actually, I've never really heard that much about the water in Chicago being that big of a deal. Yeah. Because we eat and make so much pizza. I mean, could there be enough water for us to make that much good pizza?
I don't think so.
Yeah, I don't know.
No.
You know, the lake water.
Right. Yeah, that's what I mean.
Yeah, I think it is. Well, maybe it's one of the things to discourage people from other parts of the country to try to venture out and maybe challenge for pizza excellence because, you know, you only have one of these lakes. This isn't something you can just buy or put in or get a loan for.
That's a load of crap we were dealt. I've heard that too, and it's just stupid. Because there are so many different flavors and textures of all the crusts that are out there.
Yeah, completely. I mean, as we were talking about, you know, there is, of course, the famous deep dish, but you know, a lot of people know about the Chicago tavern style, the thin crust.
And
the north side and south side actually kind of have their own distinctive styles. You know, it seems to be a little bit crispier when you find it on the far south side. And then, you know, we're going to get into stuffed, and there's so many different kinds of styles of Chicago pizza.
Just to back up that idea, though, that the water could have something to do with it, several of my friends that have moved to the West Coast have said, we've now spent years and years and years trying to find decent pizza in Los Angeles or the surrounding areas, and we can't. We can find passable, but we can't find great.
You know, having lived in L.A. and actually knowing now that there is a more of a Neapolitan style that is really popular there, which we've got here, too. You know, it's like that real classic, like, you know, from Italy, from Naples.
Yeah.
But in Chicago, we do it a little different. I mean, it's not okay when we get down to dough. It's not only actually just the water. It's the very air. It's the whole environment that we breathe. I mean, when you get into really some of the great pizzas that we've got here, which are like as good as any kind of fine dining, it's all about the fermentation. And that's seriously stuff that you can only get in the wilds of Chicago.
Yeah.
What do you mean? Like, I know when you make sourdough, I have to make a sourdough starter. That's my mission for this fall. And then you can just feed it and make sourdough.
Yeah.
But so there's fermentation involved in the, I guess, because it's yeast.
Yeah, exactly. So for some of the, especially like at a pizzeria like Polly G's in Logan Square in Chicago, they really work on what they call the Logan Squares, which is their thicker crust pizza. It's a very Chicago-specific pizza inspired by Detroit style, but they work a lot on their dough. And there's some real serious pizza dough nerds out there, and they work so, I mean, surprise, you know, they work so much about not only the fermentation times, but how much then, you know, there is a saturation of the flour. I mean, there's so many technical aspects of it, and it's seriously great pizza dough in Chicago, which we have now, is as good, if not better, than bread, because then it gets topped with stuff, you know, toppings and maybe stuff with stuff.
And if you have a bad crust, the whole pizza can go downhill. Exactly. Seriously.
And if you have a really good crust, it's just an enhancement, yeah. Right? It isn't something that's just left on the plate. It's something that gets finished too. Like my pie, I think in Wicker Park, it came from the thought process was crust first. You know, it was a baker who actually put that stuff together. It totally makes it.
You mentioned Detroit style pizza. I don't think I heard of it until about 5 or 6 years ago, and now it's becoming a huge trend. Explain the difference.
So Detroit style pizza was allegedly invented by Detroit auto workers who baked dough in old but clean rectangular oil
A little
pans.
Motor oil, right. Just around the rim.
You know, just to make it just easier to come out. Sure. But that apparently has been debunked, but I love that story. And so it is a smaller rectangular style pie. You know, one of the most commonly ones that are found here in Chicago is Jet's Pizza.
That's pretty good.
It's pretty good. I really do think it's pretty good,
caramelized
too.
Edges on it. Yeah. Thick but fluffy.
Exactly. And you get that fluffiness from fermentation, because as you will discover when you're making your own sourdough bread, that there is a real balance for how long you let that dough rise and get fluffy on the inside, because otherwise it's really just a gut bomb, and that's the problem with not so great styles of pizza sometimes.
Any advantage in having it squared off as opposed to our more traditional round shape? Is there any advantage there?
Not necessarily. No? Yeah. I mean, we have also a very long history of square style pies here in Chicago. In fact, I think the very earliest pizza that I ever had in Chicago was the bakery style pizza. And that was born in Italian bakeries. You know, there used to be, of course, one Little Italy that everybody knew about over down by UIC. But there were actually like over 20 Little Italy neighborhoods across Chicago. And so every neighborhood had a little bakery, and so they would bake some pizza, put it on the counter, and then you get slices of that, and there's always square pans.
And not a lot of cheese.
Exactly, yeah. So a lot of cheese really became something that came up more recently. And in fact, you know, some people really like that style of lighter cheese. Some people like excess.
And when you think about the different styles here, unlike, let's say, a Chicago hot dog that's got kind of a strict recipe for success, you have things, people would ask me, people ask Louisa all the time, and she's pizza inclusive. That's the way that she describes
herself.
There are so many different, it depends on how the mood strikes you, whether you want one of those kind of thin wood fired ones, whether you want like a thick Lou Malnati's, whether you're looking for stuffed. It really is, and we have it in a high level, I think, across the entire scope. And but really, there isn't one way, you know, to really enjoy it
all.
Let's take a quick break, and then we will discuss this further. If you want to jump in, we're at 312-981-7200. We'd love to hear from you. It's Bill and it's Wendy on WGN. Bill Leff, it's Wendy Snyder. Dane Neal is here. So is Louisa Chu. And some pizza royalty has entered into the stadium.
Well, you know, it's everything that is old, that is new again in history. It continues to write itself and kind of correct itself in a lot of different ways. And a name that has been out there, you know, one of those iconic names that has, whether it's kind of ebbed and flown in either popularity or anything, right, is coming back. So everyone remembers Nancy's.
Sure.
They're the creators, the originators of the stuffed pizza. Esther, my wife, used to work at Nancy's.
Oh, she did.
Yeah, so we would. So this. So it's a kind of a near and dear thing, I'm sure, to lots of people around. And it's one of the things. So we've got Dave Howie from Nancy's here. He's been there since the beginning, since where Nancy and Rocco and all of that. So there's a great history and now a great future. You got a brand new place coming up and some cool and exciting things happening.
We do. We're opening a new restaurant. We just opened it on the West Loop, 1000 West Washington. And it's very exciting. That whole area is just boomed just in the last couple of years. Just incredible.
Yeah.
So we're real excited to be there.
Dave, can I make a confession to you?
Please.
Is
it pizza related, Wendy, or something that shouldn't
be? No, yes, it's pizza related. Right. I didn't know that Nancy's was the first stuffed crust pizza. I did not know. Stuffed pizza. Stuffed pizza. I did not know that at all.
Yes.
I've heard everybody else claiming credit.
They do.
Nancy's originated it.
Yes, and Rocco did it. He invented it from an item that his mother used to make in Italy. And at the time, deep dish was very big, obviously thin, but deep dish was coming up. And everybody wanted him to open, you know, or start selling a deep dish. And he said, no, I want to be different. And that's one of the things that I loved about Rocco. He was always about being different and excellent. He was a phenomenal chef. And, he created it in 1971. He had a little pizzeria called Guy's Pizza. He did it there. He and Nancy together worked on it. But he was the driver. They put it into another restaurant. And then finally in 1974, they opened their Nancy's in Harwood Heights and Lawrence in Harlem. And it just took off.
That's a pizza pie, technically.
Oh, yeah. Well,
And here's the thing. Just as we feel that there are things that are familiar and we assume are everywhere, because right. Why wouldn't they be? They're great. Is that as there is deep dish in all sorts of different places and pizza and different incarnations around the country, stuffed pizza is truly Chicago. This is the one place that you can really, really get it.
Yes, it is. And there's a lot of reasons for it. Rocco, when he started this, he created his dough. It's a bread dough, and it's designed for the stuffed pizza. A lot of people like to take their thin crust pizza and try to make a stuff with it, and he just can't do it. I heard you earlier talking about water and everything, and it is true.
It is true.
We spent a lot of money on water filtration to get all the minerals out, then we added everything back in that we want. So Chicago has always had tremendous water.
Yeah.
So the mineral content was always low, but we take it out and do a little different scientific things. But that crust is what holds up the stuffed pizza, and you have to have a structure. And now you add in all the different spices that are here because of the Italian immigrants that came mm-hmm. here. We have all the building blocks, and we were able to make this product. And he was.
I know this is silly for you, but for people who are listening and don't know the difference between stuffed and deep dish, explain. It's not that hard, but there is a difference.
Oh, there's a big difference. Yes. So a stuffed pizza actually does have a crust, but it really turns out to be more like a noodle because we put our same dough on top. It's very, very thin of all the ingredients. So you have the dough, then the ingredients, and then this top layer. Then sauce goes on that because of the water content in the sauce. It kind of boils it.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't really see it. You don't feel it as a crust. On the edges, you can see it. But it separates the sauce from the ingredients as opposed to a deep dish that kind of the sauce melds and blends in with everything, which is delicious on its own. But it's definitely different. Then what happens when you bite into it, you get a distinct flavor of everything because the ingredients haven't been really absorbed in with or mixed in with the sauce. So it's a texture. It's a taste difference. And it's unique.
Yeah.
Very unique.
Because like a calzone, everything would be inside with the sauce.
Mixed all up. See? Exactly.
I still remember the first time I had Nancy's stuffed pizza. My dad brought us to one, my whole family to one. And it came out, and we just stared at it and laughed because it was so gigantic.
Well, that's also something else. Like, our largest stuffed pizza is a 12-inch pizza. So people look and go, oh, my gosh, $28.
Yeah.
It's 5 pounds.
Yeah.
So it feeds four people. So right. You're looking at, $6 or $7
a
person
bargain.
To eat. You can't, yeah.
Right.
It's a bargain.
When you think about that, the original location, Louisa, and you've talked about it as well, in Niles, where Nancy will be there and her daughter and son-in-law, and a lot of that history is there. Excited to hear about the new place that's coming up, and then also from the listeners getting in on things, there's an opportunity to win free Nancy's pizza for life. I'm assuming that's a pizza a day till you die. I'm kidding.
A day.
And then, one a month.
And then also 48 prizes of free pizza for a year. So how's that going to work?
Nice.
Yeah, so 48 people. This is our 48th year. In a couple of years, we'll celebrate our 50th anniversary. So 48 people get free pizza for a year. It's one a month. And they're going to get a certificate, and they can turn it in every month. But there's going to be one person that's going to get a pizza for life. And
I bet you're hoping it's not a baby who wins.
Yeah. There is age restrictions.
Yeah, you have to be 80 or up.
80 or up. Right.
Well played, Dave.
Read the fine print if you can.
Right.
It is Chicago.
That's a great contest. That's fantastic.
It is. Yeah, it's going to be kind of a random thing. There's going to be random. Everybody's going to get something.
Yeah.
There's going to be a lot of things for everybody. But, we're celebrating the West Loop. We're back in the West Loop with a full-service store. We haven't been here for a long time. Most of our stores are in the suburbs.
The southwest suburbs, right? Am I right on that?
Actually, we spread all the way west. We're out in, Geneva, Island Lake.
Oh, I didn't know
down
that.
Down to Bourbonnais. We have many stores now in Atlanta.
Oh, wow.
So in Raleigh, North Carolina.
Yeah.
So, Yeah, it's starting to spread.
That's excellent. That's great.
And so the site where people can get information, I know there's a grand opening kind of a celebration that's happening, but also on the contest and all the things going on?
Yes. So on our websites, the store that the contest is at on the West Loop, 1000 West Washington, and next Tuesday is the grand opening. So everybody's invited to get in line, and it'll be interesting. We do these things, and there'll be a lot of people. Get there early.
Here's a crazy question. We don't have a whole lot of time, but I'm curious. Pizza's always good the second day. There's no doubt about it. But some are outstanding the second day. Yeah. Some are just okay. How come?
It's how the flavors all start to really meld together. So that overnight in the refrigerator, the flavors and oils and the spices still start coming out into the tomato sauce.
Yeah.
The tomato sauce typically is a little bit acidic.
Yeah.
So it starts pulling those flavors out. So that next day, my brother, he wants the pizza the next day.
Is that right? Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And a lot of people that, are in the know, they do that. But, yeah, I'm glad you say that because the next day it's fantastic.
Oh, yeah.
Do you have to put it on a cookie sheet in the oven, or if it's thin crust, you can heat it in a skillet? It because microwaving it is just not
terrible.
Yeah, it's yeah, not good.
Air fryer is amazing for pizza.
Oh, really?
Ah. Yep. If you've got one of those air fryers, if you don't get
I
out there
get
and get one. Awesome.
Yeah.
That's great.
Well, happy National Pizza, what is it?
National Pizza Month.
National Pizza Month.
Yeah.
It's always that.
It always should be that. So nice to meet you, Dave. Luisa, great to see you. Dane, thank you for coming by. We'll take a quick break, get you some news, and then more show, including Wendy's favorite Brady, Peter Brady, will be joining us. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN.
Here's the story of a lovely lady who was bringing up three very lovely girls. All of them had hair of gold, like their mother, the youngest one in curls.
You can really hear Barry Williams, can't you?
Yeah, Barry's voice is the most dominant, no question.
You know, about a week ago, I saw something on Facebook. I live in LaGrange, and there's this restaurant, Steak and Vine, which I love going to.
Yeah.
And I see, oh, no, they're going to have Peter Brady, Christopher Knight there to serve pork chops and applesauce.
Perfect.
And it sold out before I could get tickets. And here he is now, Christopher Knight.
Christopher, explain. How can that be?
Well, there's just so many pork chops available.
That's what it is.
there's a lot of popularity when I'm around for pork chops. I have not been to a restaurant that serves pork chops without it being highly recommended.
Yeah.
That because of, maybe it's social media, maybe somewhere over my shoulder, someone is photobombing the pork chop on my plate in the restaurant.
Sure.
I do feel that I am an expert on pork chops
and applesauce.
At this point, I highly recommend them, and I did at Steak and Vine.
Oh, okay.
And that's what I had for dinner.
I'm telling you, that thing sold out so quickly because everybody, you're my favorite Brady. There, I said it.
You're sweet. Now, do you really mean it?
I do.
Because I like to say that everyone's favorite Brady is the one they're in the room with. Oh. Now, I know we're sharing a phone line. It's the equivalent. But if there's two Bradys, I rarely hear them, like, if Barry's standing with me, nobody ever comes up and says, Chris, you were my favorite Brady. Nor, I have to admit, did they say that Barry was their favorite Brady. So I'm feeling that it's very safe when you're with a Brady to claim that they're your favorite Brady.
Makes sense.
Something? We were all... I think one of the reasons the show was successful is we're all sort of a handle for a child to grab onto. And if you were a fan of the show on Friday night, that means you kind of grew up as we grew up. So for those 5 years, you probably hung on to the same handle. But if you watched it after school, depending upon how old you were, the show wasn't getting any older, but you were, you might have even changed handles as you grew up. From being, 5 years old to 11 years old. And I think that's one of the reasons for the show's success. It gives kids a place to identify and an easy handle to grab onto.
Chris, does a day go by? Do you ever live a day where somebody doesn't come up to you, and maybe more than one somebody doesn't come up to you and say, I can't tell you how much that television show meant to me? It happens every day, doesn't it?
Except for those days when someone says, I know you. Are you Seth MacFarlane?
Oh!
And on those days, I don't know what to say back to
right,
that.
Right, sure.
Other than, no, I'm not. And then I don't help them out. I figure sometime later in the day, the coin drops, and they look up and they go, oh, it wasn't Seth MacFarlane. It was Donny Osmond.
Right.
Okay, so I got that earlier in my life, too. So, but, yes, I mean, I'm recognized quite a bit. And, of course, at times like this, when there's something new on the air, it does tend to calibrate people to what you look like in the present, and it makes it easier. Some people are just wildly gifted at being able to track your age, even though they haven't seen you. Mm-hmm. So to them, you still look the same. I mean, I do have people coming, you haven't changed. And I know that they're saying that as a compliment, but the reality is I have changed a whole lot.
Right.
And I get to appreciate it more and more as we did the Very Brady renovation. And then I got to watch myself in a house that now appears that it hasn't aged at all. And then now we're older and bigger on the same scaled set.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sort of like, wow, that's what Peter looks like now.
I'm telling you.
We all.
I have been ranting and raving about this HGTV show, A Very Brady Renovation. It was so cool. I have to be honest with you. When I was watching the show, I didn't think that the inside didn't match the outside. You pointed that out on numerous episodes. And the remarkable job, and you guys did all the work as well, to renovate this to look exactly like the Brady Bunch house. Did that bring back just, like, did you feel something in your heart when you saw it all completed like that?
Continuously. I mean, and then the next step was then watching what we had done, like I just explained. I mean, it's one thing to be in that environment, and we've reanimated another character on the show, the house, which was never real to begin with, right? So we took fantasy and made it reality, and That brings back memories just being in the space. But then watching us in that space is a bit of discontinuity that I wasn't ready for. So there has been all these reveals and personal revelations through the process, and then that process not ending with just the house being done, but then watching us in the show because of the age. Really, that house on camera and in person is identical to our set. It's superior to our set because it has a fourth wall and a ceiling. And now we watch it on screen, and it's a dead ringer for the set that we worked in, except for the characters. Like I said, they're 50 years older. So it's a weird time warp.
Yeah.
But it was incredibly rewarding and unexpectedly rewarding, and an unexpected present that the network gifted us with. And so it was really a remarkable experience.
All six Bradys together in that house.
All six. Did you find, Chris, did you find a family named the Dittmeyers to move in next door?
You know, behind the house in reality is we call them a wash.
Yeah.
Would have been in its native state a river that's dry for, you know, 11 months out of the year. So I think they live on the other side of the wash.
Okay. That's fine. Yeah. Yeah. Now, in other incarnations, in other reunions, Eve Plum has said, no, I'm not interested. Thank you very much. But this time around, she wanted in. What's the difference this time?
You know, I've given a lot of clearly latitude for every individual to have a different take on their experience. Where there's six of us and six, you know, more than six different opinions on how to handle this, six different experiences. But through this process, I got to know more about what Eve's issues were, because she volunteered to in expressing those to the press. And that was, this didn't give her any of the angst any of the other Brady incarnations caused her. Because those were all playing the Jan character, for whom she's, I can't say that she's not fond, but yeah, that was a character from her past. And it's not something she cares to play anymore. And this project didn't require her to play Jan. It didn't put words in her mouth. It didn't require any acting skill. She is just interested in home remodeling. She owns a number of places. She's a oh, what's the word for those people that go thrifting? She's a thrifter or mm-hmm. whatever they're called. And she's very interested in the decorating component, especially when it comes to nostalgic heirloom type pieces, where I'm the guy that buys and wants everything new. She's the one that wants everything to have a historic relevance. So
this was perfect
this
for her.
The project was very interesting to her, and she was on board from the very beginning. Now, Eve has been very consistent. She has just never said yes to any Brady incarnation other than the Brady Brides, and perhaps that was enough for her. Clearly it was, but it wasn't as though she was communicating, I don't want to be associated with all of you,
right?
Because we're all dear friends of hers. She just didn't want to have to play Jan anymore, and that's understandable. I, on the other hand, don't have a problem hearkening back to Peter, because I kind of like him. Frankly, mm-hmm. he was me. You know, he was me. It was the outside of perhaps Cindy and Greg and Marcia,
mm-hmm.
they had hard etched ideas about what the youngest and the oldest are. We all kind of do. We all have the kind of a quintessential caricature of what the oldest son and the youngest daughter may be in a family. But everybody else in between has a whole lot of freedom. And now I was sort of that in my own family. And I relish being a middle child. I don't even know what this middle child syndrome is. I've done some research on it. Really, that doesn't exist. It's, in fact, the better place to be because the expectations aren't leveled at you. But nonetheless,
yeah.
because I was, let be me anyway, the character over time was being written for the personalities that played those roles. The writers literally noticed what your instincts were and picked up on them. And mine was, you know, sort of a little devil child, but harmlessly so.
Right.
And they wrote that in. And as a result, I am tickled by the character because he is sort of who I was, you know, growing up. And
Chris, hold your thought for a second. We are short on time. We're going to take a quick break, and then we'd love to talk to you about this documentary project you have, True Love, the film. So we'll take a quick break. He's Chris Knight. He is Peter Brady, my favorite Brady, and we'll continue talking to him next on WGN.
Now, look, fellas. Marcia, Jan, and Cindy are all part of our family.
Still left, it's Wendy Snyder. Our guest is Christopher Knight. You know him as Peter Brady, by far the most beloved of the Brady Bunch, the original six.
Being very kind.
Yep. Chris, what is this documentary you're working on, True Love the Film? Tell us more.
True Love the Film is our love child. I've recently partnered with an old friend in the production company that he had already started, and he came across identified a project because he came across an individual, Callie Truelove, who suffers from Williams syndrome, a chromosomal syndrome not familiar with many at all. And one of the aspects of Williams syndrome is that it leaves those having the condition with unique characteristic traits. They're not all the same, but in Callie's case, that characteristic trait is this inability to see anything but good in people. And watching how others react in their interactions with her is just glory. It's all love. And frankly, with a name, and it's her real last name, True Love, there seems to be a need to pay attention to this girl. I think she can bring hope. She can certainly teach all of us how to treat our fellow man better, with less suspicion and more love. We want to give her time in front of America, the world. So in during this process of getting to know her, they'll also become more familiar with Williams syndrome.
Where can people see this? True Love, the film is shown where?
The film is not done yet. We're in the midst of filming True Love, the film. But True Love, the film, to learn more about it, it's truelovethefilm.com. We have a campaign of See a Heart, Share a Heart on Instagram, where if anybody sees a heart in nature, take a photograph of it and post it. They're all around us, and this is one of Callie's great talents. She can find hearts everywhere. She's just a wonderful spirit and somebody that we're making a documentary on because we think she's cool and the world needs more loving like she's able to provide.
What a sweet concept. I can't wait to meet her through the film. And it's truelovethefilm.com. Also, you're going to be busy because there's a very Brady renovation holiday edition coming up. I can't wait to see that.
Yeah, that's December 16th, Monday, December 16th, I believe at 9 p.m. Yeah, we continue with taking the house into the holiday season.
Was there or wasn't there a rivalry between the Bradys and the Partridges?
No, there wasn't.
No.
People assume that we all live on the same block, you know, like all the kids' shows, they work over here on this block. I mean, obviously, you assumed that we worked in that house, too. It's amazing how much we assumed our audience knew that they didn't. No, we didn't have a rivalry with the Partridges. We met them. I know I met them once. And that was, we both appeared at the Christmas Lane Parade in Hollywood, the Hollywood Lane Parade, back in the day, one season. And it was during that we met. Other than that, no, we didn't film on the same lot. We certainly watched their show. But like any fan that didn't write in to learn about those on the television show, we were fans of their show but had no connection.
You were my favorite Partridge, too, if you want to know the truth.
Now I know you're lying.
And on Nanny and the Professor, you were the best also.
Thank you. Yes, attribute all of that to me.
Yeah.
It's a pleasure to talk to you. If you're ever in the area again and can come in the studio, we'd love to hang with you. Thank you so much.
If I ever go to Steak and Vine again, we'll make sure to save a table.
All right, perfect.
Chris, thank you so much. Continued success. We'll all be watching your projects.
Well, thank you, Bill. And thank you, Wendy.
Take
care. Absolutely.
Christopher Knight, everybody.
Very excited.
Your favorite Brady. It happens. I know.
All right.
And rightfully so. The news is next. That'll come from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom right here on WGN.